I appreciate Brian's song selection this morning. Out of number 275, the song called Ancient Words, notice the second verse, just a couple lines from the second verse. Holy words of our faith handed down to this age came to us through sacrifice. Oh, heed the faithful words of Christ. And indeed, the story of how we got the Bible is the greatest story, I think, in all of at least archaeology, at least within that subject. How we got the Bible took many, many acts of sacrifice at the hands of many, many people over the generations. And one chapter from that story of how we got the Bible is what I want to look at today. And the beginning of that chapter happened many, many generations ago and has only come to light within the last century. East of the city of Jerusalem, the mountainous landscape plummets about 1,200 meters to the lowest point on planet Earth, which is the Dead Sea, at least on the surface of the Earth, not in the ocean. Some of the most dramatic biblical stories take place in the rocky caves of this region, between the Judean hills and the Dead Sea itself. Here in the intense heat of the Judean desert, we can almost visualize David fleeing from King Saul, seeking refuge in the desert's mountain caves, or Jesus rejecting the temptations of the devil in the same wilderness. For thousands of years, the Judean desert held secrets buried in its sands, only to be revealed by a young Bedouin shepherd in 1947. As the story goes, a shepherd of one of the local tribes left his flock of sheep and goats to search for a stray animal. And amid the crumbling limestone cliffs that line the northwestern rim of the Dead Sea around the site of Qumran, he found a cave in the crevice of a steep, rocky hillside. Intrigued, the shepherd cast a stone into the dark interior of the cave, only to be startled by the sound of breaking pots somewhere within. The sound echoed around the world, so to speak, because he had stumbled upon one of the greatest archaeological and literary finds of the 20th century, and perhaps in all of human history, what we call today the Dead Sea Scrolls. Upon entering the cave, the young Bedouin found a mysterious collection of clay jars. And in some of these clay jars, he found scrolls, many of them very well maintained, very well preserved. And he found scrolls, some of them wrapped in linen, some of them blackened with age, some of them not even legible, but some of them, to be sure, entirely legible. So he took several companions with him, and he scooped up these scrolls, and he took them to an antiquities dealer in the region and sold a few of them. And within a few years, historians and archaeologists and scholars of ancient languages discovered and examined and translated hundreds of these scrolls, many of them complete and preserved in what really could be considered pristine condition for being well over 2,000 years old. And among this collection of scrolls, about 230 manuscripts are referred to as biblical scrolls. About 230 of them are copies of works that make up what we call the Old Testament. In fact, in the collection of the Dead Sea Scrolls, every single Old Testament book is found represented except for the book of Esther, Isaiah, the books of the law, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, or the Psalms make up the majority and the most complete of these biblical scrolls. Now, some books of the Old Testament are simply represented on scraps, and it's just a few words that you can see on scraps that are maybe the size of a dollar bill today, but they're there, represented at least in some way. The significance of this discovery cannot be overstated, because until their discovery in 1947, the oldest manuscript of the Old Testament that was in existence was only around 1,000 years old. You can look that one up, the Aleppo Codex, and that was probably transcribed around the year 930 AD. Now think about that. David wrote the Psalms around 1000 A.D. Isaiah wrote his prophecy around 800 to 700 B.C., excuse me, around 700-800 B.C. So the oldest Old Testament manuscript we had was in 930 A.D., pretty far away removed from the original. Now what we have are the Dead Sea Scrolls, which brings us a full 1,000 years back closer to when those things were written. We need to think about this here and understand the significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I want to spend some time with you this morning, just a little bit of time, looking at some of the prophecies about the Messiah that can be found in the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves. Now, while the Dead Sea Scrolls are not the original Hebrew Bible, they do bring us back closer to the original by about 1,000 years. Now, the most famous of these scrolls is probably the Great Isaiah Scroll. It's the only intact biblical scroll of the collection. And it was likely transcribed around the 2nd century BC or even earlier. Some believe that it's possible, just possible, not confirmed, but possible, based on the quality of the Great Isaiah Scroll and the care that was taken to preserve it intact, that it could actually be a copy of the original Isaiah prophecy. And the reason why some give credence to that is the fact that in some synagogues today, the scrolls that they use in their own services today, some of those scrolls are well over 500 years old and they're still in use in synagogues today. So it wouldn't be unreasonable to see Isaiah's scroll, his original prophecy, still in circulation by the time of the 2nd or 3rd century B.C. So it's certainly possible that the Great Isaiah scroll was taken directly from, or perhaps one literary generation removed from, the original written prophecy from Isaiah. Now, we need to be careful to understand what can be proved from the Dead Sea Scrolls, because we can't overstate something. We can't go too far in our assessment of something. We need to understand what can be proved. We have to be honest about the limits of what the Dead Sea Scrolls can illustrate. They are not the originals. And what you see of the Dead Sea Scrolls, of those 230 manuscripts, that's not what David wrote on a piece of parchment back in 1000 BC. Not least written by the hand of David. The items in the Dead Sea Scrolls collection that are contemporary with Jesus and his disciples also provide a little bit of evidence of his ministry, but it's not like the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls went out of their way to record all of Jesus' life either. We cannot prove, based on the collection of these manuscripts, that a man named Isaiah wrote Isaiah 53 in 700 BC. And I cannot prove to you, based on the Dead Sea Scrolls, that a man named David wrote Psalm 22 in 1000 BC. But here's what I can prove. Here's what the Dead Sea Scrolls do prove. We can prove that such prophecies predicted out of Isaiah 53 or Psalm 22 or Psalm 110, we can prove with astonishing accuracy the life, the work, the death of the Messiah between 200 and 300 BC. Now, when did Jesus live and work here on planet Earth? In the 1st century AD. So there are scrolls that exist in these collections that were written between 200 and 300 B.C. that prophesy about the Messiah in incredible detail. That's worth a look, isn't it? And I guess the question that I would ask is, do you have the ability to predict the same things that the Dead Sea Scrolls did? In 200 B.C., whoever was transcribing the Dead Sea Scrolls was writing things from Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22 and other messianic prophecies that showed what the Messiah would look like, where he would be born, the circumstances of his birth, his life, his work, his ministry, the circumstances surrounding his death, and ultimately what he would leave behind. And that's over 200 years before Jesus was even born, that these things prove and illustrate. Now, unless you have the money to go see the Dead Sea Scrolls yourselves, and there are collections around the world that do have portions of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it would be quite an investment on your part to go see them. So I say this entirely hypothetically, that you can, with your own eyes, again, if you have the money, hypothetically, with your own eyes, you can look at a scroll that was written 200 years before Jesus lived that describes the man of sorrows in Isaiah 53. That describes the scene of his crucifixion in Psalm 22. Piercing his hands, piercing his side, I'm poured out like water. My bones are out of joint, but I can count every one of them. They've cast lots for my clothes. You can see that with your own eyes. 200 years before it even happened to Jesus. Predicted in great detail. So for Bible skeptics and for Bible doubters, it's easy to dismiss the Old Testament as mere coincidence or maybe political propaganda. But when this dismissal is actually put to the test, it fails woefully. Because if we applied the same standard to any predictions made today about the future, would we be able to match the accuracy of the Old Testament messianic prophecies? If I asked you to look in the future to the year 2200, 2200 AD, could you give a basic sequence of successive world powers the way that Daniel does in his prophecies? Would you be able to explain, even in the most basic detail, the political conditions of the time period of 2200 AD? Would you be able to predict the most important figure of the year 2200, the most important person in the year 2200? Could you predict where he would be born, and the circumstances of his birth, and the basic details of his work and his ministry? Would you be able to explain his or her greatest accomplishments, the most important person on planet Earth in the year 2200? Would you be able to detail his or her death, including the attitudes and actions of those who caused it? That's all I'm asking. Just 2200 AD, just tell me the most basic details of life on planet Earth for the year 2200. You wouldn't be able to do it. So for the sake of argument, what would the Bible skeptic do if detailed documentation of the events of the American Revolution were discovered? Found in a cave somewhere outside Boston, Massachusetts, but said documents were clearly and undeniably written in the year 1500. What if in a cave outside Boston you found documents and radiocarbon dating proved when they were written? And in the year 1500 AD, these documents explained the basic details of George Washington. And George Washington's early career as a young military lieutenant in the British Army. And also, these documents written in 1500 AD explain George Washington's greatest accomplishments in basic detail, just very basic detail. And then these documents also explained, again in basic detail, the circumstances surrounding George Washington's death. Now, what would we do with those documents written 200 years before the events actually happened? What would your conclusion be about those who wrote those documents? So what I want to do with the rest of the lesson, and this is really where I'm going with all this, and it won't take too long, I don't think, but I want to look at messianic prophecies, and there are hundreds of messianic prophecies out of the Old Testament, but I want to limit our look today at just the messianic prophecies that can be seen with our own eyes out of the Dead Sea Scrolls collection. Now, like I said earlier, the Dead Sea Scrolls are not a complete body of the Old Testament. There are bits and pieces, there are scraps of parchment in there that represent something from every Old Testament book except for Esther. So I want to look at just the messianic prophecies that can be seen with our own eyes today out of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Documents that radiocarbon dating and language studies have shown to be written several centuries before the first century AD. Several centuries before Jesus was born, lived, and died. What do the Dead Sea Scrolls prove about the Messiah? Well, let's begin here. In Daniel chapter 9 and verse 25. And of course, there's more in the context that we could look at, but let's just limit ourselves to this one reference here for the sake of time. But in Daniel chapter 9, and let's begin here in verse 24. And this is it's a whole study on its own, by the way, so let's not get bogged down in the details of the prophecy itself. But notice here, Daniel 9, 24, 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city. Now, the weeks prophetically are years, okay? So when he says 70 weeks, he's speaking code language there. In any good prophecy, there's going to be code language that requires some interpretation. The 70 weeks are 70 years, all right? 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. What do you think that's talking about? At the end of the 70 weeks, what is he talking about there? So you are to know and discern in verse 25 that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. And after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And its end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. So notice what this is saying. If weeks, all right, if weeks are referring to 7 years, that's the most typical way of interpreting it, is that a week equals 7 years. Then if you look at the math here of these 7 weeks and 62 weeks, we're looking at 434 years. That brings us to the life of Christ from when Daniel was writing this prophecy, or at least to the end of when Daniel would have been writing this prophecy. So the Messiah would come here, he says, in a certain time period. Not 100 years earlier, or 100 years later, or 1,000 years in the future, but within a certain time period, the Messiah would come, and after that, Jerusalem would be destroyed. Jesus came in the first century, and only 40 years later, less than 40 years later, Jerusalem was a rubble heap. Now notice Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy chapter 18, a prophecy about the coming Messiah here from Moses. One of the great prophecies, by the way, it's referred to in the book of Acts and several other places here in Deuteronomy chapter 18, beginning in verse 18. I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. It shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, but he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. But the prophet who shall speak a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or which he shall speak in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. And you'll say in your heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not come about or come true, this is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously, and you shall not be afraid of him. And I read all the way through the end of the chapter to point something out, that not only is there a messianic prophecy in verse 19, really verses 14 through 19, not only is there a messianic prophecy, but there's an assurance from God here through Moses that says, and when it comes to prophecy, all you have to do is have some patience and see how things turn out. And if the things that a prophet says don't come true, well, guess what? Don't listen to him. But the prophet that prophesies something that does come true, truly he has come from God. That's why we bring all of this up, right? That's why we bring all this up. Because Moses prophesied many years even before David did that a prophet like me would come from among you, from among your own countrymen, and you shall listen to him because he'll speak the words of God. The messianic prophecy. From Isaiah 7, verse 14, we learn that he will be born of a virgin, and that comes true in Matthew chapter 1, verses 18 through 25. From Micah 5 and verse 2, we learn that he will be born in Bethlehem, and of course we know the circumstances surrounding that in Matthew 2, verse 1, or in Luke chapter 2, verses 4 through 7. And interestingly enough, it's not like Bethlehem was the hometown for Jesus' earthly parents. It's not like they had any reason to be in Bethlehem except because of the census that was being taken. And I think that adds even more credibility to the whole thing, that it was prophesied that he would be born in Bethlehem, and yet his parents weren't even living in Bethlehem at the time. Yet the circumstances proved to be true. In Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 through 7, his first work will be in Galilee, and he'll reach out to the Gentiles, a formerly alienated people. He'll be a son born from the lineage of David, and he will build and uphold a spiritual kingdom. In Isaiah chapter 35, verses 5 through 6, among his many works, he will give sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf, which Jesus did in abundance. You can read Matthew chapter 11, verses 2 through 6. In fact, when the disciples of John the Baptist came to Jesus to ask, "Are you the one we've been waiting for? Are you the expected one?" the evidence that Jesus pointed to was the fact that he was healing the blind and the deaf, and that many people were being healed from their illnesses. And he refers back to this prophecy in Isaiah 35 and says, "Now you go back to John the Baptist and tell him everything that you have seen today, and he'll understand the messianic references." In Isaiah 42, verses 1 through 9, I wish we had the time to study this one. This is a sermon all by itself. We learn here that the Messiah will have a humble demeanor and an unassuming personality. I want to read this one. Just, you know, sometimes you go through in your notes and you know you don't have time to do something, but then while you're preaching it, you just go, but you got to read it. Isaiah 42, beginning in verse 1. "Behold, my servant," and by the way, this is quoted in Matthew chapter 12, verses 18 through 21. "Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I've put my spirit upon him. He'll bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he's established justice in the earth, and the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law." And that's the personality of Jesus. Now, like I said earlier in the lesson, if we were to find some document in a cave in Boston that was clearly written in 1500 AD that described the personality of George Washington, that described the personality of George Washington 200 years before he even lived, what would we do with that document? And with your own eyes, you can find in the Dead Sea Scrolls Isaiah 42 and read about Jesus. And it's like you're reading Jesus right there on the page. A man who is so tender-hearted. A man who was so unassuming in how he lived. That's Jesus. In Isaiah chapter 28 and verse 16, "He'll be the great stone of Zion upon which all else will be built," referring to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 6. In the end, though, what happens to that stone? That stone will be rejected. The stone that the builders rejected, as it says in Psalm 118, which is also found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the stone which the builders rejected, that stone became the chief cornerstone. And we see these referenced in several passages in the New Testament, Acts chapter 4, verse 11, for example. Now, with the rest of our time, I want to look at two great messianic prophecies, Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22. Perhaps the most obvious of all the messianic prophecies in the Old Testament, they certainly do stand apart from the rest as being such epic passages about Jesus. In Isaiah 53, we read about the man of sorrows, and having been rejected, the man of sorrows will be beaten and abused for the sake of the very people who are harming him. Isaiah 53 says that he would be silent before his accusers, just as he was in Matthew 26, verses 62 and 63, or in Matthew 27, verses 12 through 14. Isaiah 53 says that after his death, he would be buried with the rich, or in a rich man's tomb, as some translations say, We see that in Matthew chapter 27, verses 59 and 60, as Joseph of Arimathea speaks up for the body of Christ and says, I will take care of the body, and he ends up putting Jesus' body in his own tomb. That was a rich man who had a rich man's tomb specially prepared for his body that he was willing to give up to be used for the body of Jesus. He will be crucified with criminals, according to Isaiah 53. The chapter also says the process of humiliation and suffering would be one of incredibly epic proportions. That nobody would feel pain the way that he feels pain. That nobody would bear a burden the way he bears the burden. Pick up in verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted. Yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living? For the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due. His grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his tomb, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. Verse 10, but the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief, if he would render himself as a guilt offering. And that's the point there, isn't it? It's not just predicting that the Messiah would die, it's predicting why the Messiah would die. The prophecies don't just predict the circumstances of Jesus' life and his death, they predict the purpose of his life and his death. And I think that's the more significant purpose behind these messianic prophecies. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he will see his offspring, he'll prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. As a result of his anguish of his soul, he'll see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, as he will bear their iniquities. And finally, from Psalm 22. In Psalm 22, we read about the circumstances of the crucifixion itself, beginning in verse 11. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and a roaring lion. I'm poured out like water. What happened when that Roman soldier speared him in the side? What came out of his body? But blood and water mixed together. All my bones are out of joint. In order to get him on the cross, they very likely would have had to dislocate his shoulders and his elbows. My joints are out. My bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It's melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. His strength so dried up, he couldn't even carry the cross up that hill. They required help to do it. My tongue cleaves to my jaws. He was so thirsty that he asked for water on the cross. My strength, my thirst, laid in the dust of death in verse 15. Verse 16, for dogs have surrounded me, a band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet, but I can count all my bones. I think what he says there is, I count all my bones as intact. In order to speed up the process of dying, Roman soldiers would break the legs of those who were being crucified so that they couldn't use their own legs to prop themselves up to get a breath. It would help hasten the process of death. And yet when they came to Jesus to break his legs, he was already dead. So they chose not to break any of his bones. I can count all my bones as if they were intact. They look, they stare at me, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. And you can read about all of this in John chapter 19. In John chapter 19, we read about the way that they chose not to break his legs. In John 19, verses 23 and 24, we read how they cast lots for his clothes. When doubting Thomas wanted to see for himself the evidence, Jesus held his hands out. And if you want to put your fingers in the holes in my hands, then they're right here for you. Tangible evidence that I am, in fact, the Messiah, that I am raised from the dead. Now, if just a few of these things came true, I understand that it might be reasonable for a Bible skeptic to dismiss them as mere coincidence or accident. But the fact that so many details parallel the events of Jesus' life, the fact that if you just limit your inquiry to just what you can find on scraps of scrolls and parchment paper found in a cave in the desert, that if you limit your inquiry to just what's found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and this is what you can learn about the Messiah from that myopic study, and I have ignored hundreds of other messianic prophecies from the Old Testament, but if you just limit your study to what's found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, is this not some kind of evidence to believe that Jesus is who He claimed to be? And that the Old Testament, even if you limit it to what's found in the Dead Sea Scrolls collection, is certainly worth a look? Can't the Bible skeptic at least acknowledge that? Reason must lead us to conclude that Jesus is who He claimed to be. It's not just some shot in the dark to believe in Him. It's not mere superstition or oral tradition. Conspiracy theories about the prophecies being written after the fact hold no water. The moment that that Bedouin shepherd crawled into that cave and found what he found, every argument about the Old Testament being some kind of a fallacy or a forgery or a fake or a conspiracy was blown out of the water. And while the Christian's faith shouldn't require such things as the Dead Sea Scrolls, this ancient collection of documents is most certainly a faith builder because it is literally a tangible confirmation that what we read in the Gospels, what we read in the Messianic prophecies, is the handiwork of God. Do you believe in Jesus? If you do, you have an opportunity right now to make that belief known. You will be saved if you acknowledge that belief by confession, and if you are willing to be baptized in the body of Christ to have all of your sins washed away. So whatever spiritual need you might have, I encourage you to please come forward as we stand and sing.